The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going in this COVID-19 crisis. That's Africa Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP. The moment Angie Mochecha says something notable in terms of when your children will be expected to go back to school or will be able to go back to school, we will let you know. Eyewitness News following every word of her speech this evening. Basically what she's saying so far, that the key principle of guiding the workers' safety of teachers, of the pupils, absolutely critical, of course. I mean, with South Africa having 16,433 COVID-19 cases and the number growing in excess of 1,000 a day right now, with the death toll at 286, you can never be too careful when it comes to doing things like reopening schools. What is encouraging, and what she has said so far, is that they are looking at trends from countries around the world and learning from those trends. Different countries, different approaches. South Africa will need a very unique approach to its crowded classroom situation as we go into the winter season, which is notorious for seasonal colds and flu. And then you've got the added complexity, of course, of COVID-19 thrown into the mix. And that makes life very, very difficult to navigate indeed. We'll talk about the levels of the lockdowns. And we'll also talk this evening as to why it is that the private healthcare sector isn't seeing an investment boom right now. Wayne McCurry with the markets, results today from Rhodes Foods. I'm interested in his view on interest rates. We do know that the Reserve Bank's Monetary Policy Committee will make its decision on Thursday. And the governor will be releasing his decision, or their decision, on interest rates come Thursday. We'll see what Wayne McCurry's view is on that. Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros. Neville Mandimika from RMB with our Africa business focus. And wrapping it all up tonight with Prof. Nick Benedell. What is the role of academia in a crisis like this? And how does the process work when it comes to research and analysis and testing of potential solutions to crises? All of that tonight on The Money Show.
702. Bruce is on The Money Show.
Well, level three, and it sounds like nirvana. It sounds like freedom. Certainly it sounds a whole lot better than level four and infinitely preferable to level five. We know how tough level five was. The concern now is that we are seeing not level four, but level four light. We're seeing compromises being made, and we're seeing the regulations watered down. So level four light is kind of the private school version of level three, if you know what I mean, because by the time we get to level three, will there even be any difference at all in our experience? When is it cut? Will we even notice, I wonder? Philip DeVette, who's associate editor at Business Insider, has been applying himself to this little conundrum. It's almost like 50 shades of lockdown, Philip DeVette.
It is, Rama. Hello, Bruce. Yes, you know, it seems like a million years ago, but it's only on the 25th of April that the consultation document came out on the levels. So yeah, it's a couple of weeks, literally. But South Africa then and South Africa now are two very different places. And the vision for the lockdown levels was level five is the hard lockdown. Nothing moves. Level four is basically hard lockdown, but you can have food deliveries. And then level three is when things start to happen. At level three, you see more things on shelves. You know, you can maybe buy a couple of things online. And as you say, exactly, we've seen such rapid movement in terms of the level four regulations. A lot of the things that we were supposed to see in three are already part of everyday life. The sale of books, open hardware stores, car sales were supposed to come back in level three. You know, all these things are theoretically available. And then, of course, the opening up of e-commerce now means you can buy a TV from Macro or Pick and Pay. You just have to pay for it online before you go and collect it. You know, for people with access to credit cards on the internet, that's not that much different from what level three will be.
And then booze and smokes, that's the only thing anybody really cares about right now. I've got some desperate messages from people, some quite well-known people as well. I could disclose who, but then they might never speak to me again. But a particularly well-known person in the broadcast industry is so grumpy because they've run out of wine and is desperate to know. So please tell him when he can buy some wine. I think this is part of level three, is it not? And that sort of is expected to kick in there or thereabouts on the 1st of June.
It is. And the caveat here is we have not been able to get a glimmer of inside info about what's happening in the drafting. We know that Cogta Minister Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma is busily drafting on level three regulations. We don't know what is going to come out of that. We do know that the plan back on 25th of April, when the thinking was a lot more hardcore and a lot more restrictive, at that point, the plan was that at level three, there would be limited alcohol sales only in the morning, some days of the week, that tobacco products would be for sale. And then the other big change, that there would be domestic air travel again, although you would have to show that you have a need for it. But, you know, essential services personnel and people who really needed to move would in theory be able to catch a flight again between Johannesburg and Cape Town.
All of these things are absolutely critical in opening up an economy. But here is the conundrum government faces. South Africa's got a rising caseload. We are seeing more than 1,000 confirmations per day as our testing improves. And as we target our testing, we see Cape Town at the epicenter of this in the Western Cape, 10,000 cases in the Western Cape, 16, nearly 17,000 nationwide. And it's not clear just how well the smaller provinces are testing. So we don't know for a fact just how widespread the infections are. We are looking to open up in a rising pandemic environment, which is completely unlike anything else that's happening anywhere else in the world right now. Other economies are opening up as infection rates are declining after apparently peaking.
I can't tell you much about the epidemiology of it, Bruce, but I can tell you about the political and the economic pressures that government is facing. And we're seeing those coming from all sides now. In this week, we've seen organized labor move much more strongly towards opening up with conditions and being concerned about safety, but pushing for opening up. We've seen some of the scientists that advise government break ranks and come out openly and use quite harsh words about lockdown. We've had people from the economic side and, of course, from business side push very hard indeed. So if you are a government and you're looking at your constituencies at this point, I'm not sure where in that spread you're going to find people who are going to be opposed to quite a rapid relaxation of lockdown. As best we can tell, all the voices in the choir are now going, this thing needs to be relaxed. We need to look at the livelihoods. The time is now.
Philip De Wet, thank you. Associate Editor at Business Insider on The Money Show this evening. Listening to that is Lisa Eustace. She is Sector Head for Healthcare, Construction and Hospitality at APSA Corporate and Investment Banking. And with South Africa expecting a peak in COVID-19 infections in about September, I mean, that's, I think, the popular science right now. You would think that private healthcare would be coining it. Private healthcare would be booming. But share prices are reflecting a big drop in earnings. The reason is actually really, really interesting. Lisa Eustace has been doing her research into this particular topic. Why are these big hospital groups in particular, Lisa, losing revenue?
Good evening, Bruce, and good evening to the listeners. You're quite right. Ordinarily, you would think the healthcare sector should benefit from a health crisis, especially such as COVID-19. However, the largest impact that these hospitals are experiencing is as a result of the cancellation of elective surgeries, which can account up to 50 to 60% of the hospital revenue. So, in the absence of these surgeries, which generally account for a higher margin, as well as inability to actually cut costs, which would be your nurses largely, and the hospitals are feeling the pressure on their liquidity and some on their covenant levels.
I mean, like a hotel business, a hospital needs to keep beds occupied for as much time as possible. They've got some fixed overheads. They've got big, expensive hospitals and electricity to pay for. They've got staff numbers. They can't exactly lay off their staff and say, we'll give you a call if we get a couple of COVID cases. Okay. They've got to keep everybody on standby, don't they?
Well, absolutely. You know, without nurses, there's no one to treat the patients. And even, you know, at occupancies of as low as 35%, ordinarily you would see, you know, you would see in other sectors, as we have already, huge job losses and furloughs across the sectors. However, the healthcare companies need to keep the nurses on to prepare for the peak. But at the same time, Bruce, they are also incurring much larger costs in the procurement of PPE. And they've seen about 5 to 6 times increase in their PPE costs, not only from price increases, which have also been a different story to talk about, but also because of the volumes that they need. They estimate that in some hospitals you can spend 500 rand per person per patient on PPE, and this could be the norm going forward.
And this then adds to the problem that all of us face, particularly when it comes to private healthcare, and that is healthcare inflation. I mean, we look at what happens to our medical aid rates on an annual basis, and I see Discovery's got a big briefing on its expectations coming up tomorrow, but there are other healthcare schemes as well. And, you know, when you're seeing your medical aid rates going up by twice the rate of inflation at this stage, as inflation looks to go possibly even negative, we're going to see big impact in terms of the cost of healthcare in South Africa, whether we're using it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. The medical aid funders have actually been quite supportive of the hospital sector, some pre-funding where they can. But I think what's going to be more pertinent going forward is what's left in people's pockets. Now, and the growth of the private sector depends solely on the growth of private medical insurance. And in the absence of being able to be paid more because companies are earning less profits, what are South Africans going to do? I mean, it'll be their last cut, but certainly you might see many South Africans trading down in their hospital plans, which means that you're going to have increase in sort of your network providers. And those hospitals that form part of the network, restricted network providers, will need to be very, very cost conscious. And those that are not focused on cost now are going to suffer even more than they are.
And there's also been a drop-off. And again, elective surgeries is one thing, but the self-inflicted injuries, the things that we do to ourselves. I mean, people still fall off ladders in their bathrooms and bash their heads, and that's, you know, good revenue for hospitals. But things like car wrecks and, you know, the stupid stuff is also, again, a big revenue generator for hospitals and for the emergency wards. And for so many of us, I mean, you've really got to be at risk of losing a limb to want to expose yourself to a waiting room in a doctor's surgery or a hospital right now.
Absolutely, and there's we've even seen A&Es you know, come to the banks for assistance in from a financial perspective, as they are feeling the pinch as well. And what we will start to see now is we will start to see an increase in the rate of infection, purely because of the relaxation of lockdown, but also because we're coming into winter, so the normal flu virus is going to be much more prevalent, as well as the fact that many of the surgeons are actually now starting to operate on what is called medically necessary time-sensitive procedures. And with, you know, with the increase in infection and some increase in elective surgeries, we will see an increase in occupancies, and have already seen since March some of those occupancies increase across the private players.
Lisa Eustace, thank you. She's Sector Head for Healthcare, Construction and Hospitality at APSA Corporate and Investment Banking. Angie Motshekga confirming this evening, the Minister for Basic Education, that the 1st of June is the planned start date for schools, starting, as they said a couple of weeks ago, grade 7 and 12 initially, plus small schools as well. Teachers expected to go back from the 25th of May so that they can be there to get trained, I suppose, to receive PPE clothing, whatever is required in order to make the schooling environment safe for your and my children. You don't want to be sending your kids into a festering petri dish. There just makes no sense in that. And the Department of Education taking this deadly seriously, and of course learning from global lessons. South Africa tops 16,433 COVID-19 confirmed cases.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Another really, really good day for markets. The All Share Index on the JSE up by more than 1% by the close. Nearly 52,000 on the All Share Index. Big demand coming through for industrial stocks, particularly Naspers and Prosus, continuing to fly the flag. A couple of nice bounces in other counters too. Wayne McCurry from Wealth and Investments at First National Bank with us on The Money Show this evening. There's no crisis anywhere in the world, Wayne McCurry. We what, 6-7%? Below where we were when the crisis started. This is a big, big bounce. Is it the sucker rally?
Bruce, unfortunately, we certainly think so, yes. You know, as I started my market commentary last week, crisis, what crisis? Then the market has gone up too quickly, too soon, in our view, and we're due for a retracement. I don't think we'll hit the previous lows, and the market will recover from that, so not by any stretch of the imagination saying we're going into a prolonged bear market. But just roughly speaking, the share market was 60,000, is now roughly speaking 50,000. So, you know, that's hardly a crisis.
It isn't, but it's not reflecting any kind of reality. I mean, The Economist put it so beautifully. Their cover last week, I think it was, this chasm between Wall Street and Main Street, between the economic reality on the street that we are all experiencing, the job losses, the cutbacks in expenditure, the cutbacks in our ability to spend, plus the stock market, which is pricing in, some kind of sort of happy day scenario.
Now, look, Bruce, remember this market does look forward. So the next year in the valuation of any market is only about 15% of the total market value. The subsequent years is 85% of the stock market value. So the stock market itself, in theory, will not reflect the same downturn as the current economic situation. In other words, the market does look ahead. But it's probably going to take us and maybe the rest of the world 2 to 3 years, economically speaking, to get back to where we were before the virus. And certainly in South Africa, it wasn't a particularly good place. So the rally has just been too quick, too soon. But as we all know, the economy is recovering. And I say is because we're probably over the worst of the actual economic data. Probably happened last week or the week before, because economic activity is picking up off a very, very low base. And just on that, you know, when we get the GDP numbers in South Africa for the quarter to June, this is going to show on an annualized basis, and I stress that, -20%, -30%. I mean, it's going to be truly horrific. And I think the market hasn't quite digested that, the absolute avalanche of bad company news and bad economic news that we're going to get over the next 6 months.
But one looks at the traffic volumes on the roads. One looks at some of the traffic cam pictures that get posted on social media. And I think in Cape Town today, there was a slowdown on the N2 just simply because there were too many cars on the road. That's kind of normal-ish, which implies that, you know, while the second quarter is going to be horrendous from a growth perspective, the recovery in quarters 3 and 4, provided we don't see a forced retracement in stages, could very well alleviate some of the worst excesses of the second quarter collapse.
Correct. Yeah, as I said, the economy, the physical economy, probably hit its bottom 2 weeks ago, because that's one of the anecdotal things I've been listening to on the radio. There are now traffic reports. And when you drive around, clearly it's not back to normal, but there are significantly more cars and more activity than what we saw in the initial 5 weeks, significantly more.
Good news today from the business rescue practitioners at Comair, saying that they believe that the airline may very well survive. It doesn't necessarily mean that it will survive as a listed entity and the share price will be worth anything, unfortunately, but at least there may be an airline to fly.
Yeah, Bruce, I think that's an important point to note. Any business that was viable under normal economic circumstances will probably be viable when the economy becomes normal again, but not maybe not under the current owners.
Yeah, okay. So, and that's, I mean, Bidvest is a big shareholder there. And, of course, there have been private shareholders invested in Comair too. Rhodes Food Group, any sort of bits of hope there? One would have thought that a company that produces lots of ready meals for Woolies and makes lots of tinned foods would have done okay.
Well, look, every company is going to be affected, but they will obviously do better than other companies and other listed companies. And it's interesting when they tell you that their sales in March compared to March last year were up 22% as people started to hoard just prior to the slowdown. And obviously their long life and their canned goods did well. But yeah, it wasn't a bad set of results, but clearly they also say, look, we're actually not sure what's going to happen and how it's all going to work. So we'll wait and see. And virtually every single company is doing that at the moment. very few people. In fact, they only know one company that's actually given guidance, and there it was down between 40 and 60%. Earnings will be down between 40 and 60%. Otherwise, internationally, locally, no company is giving any guidance at all.
Wayne McCurry, he is from Wealth and Investments at First National Bank on The Money Show this evening. Thank you for joining us this evening. Wayne McCurry, founder of quite a morbid but hilarious, morbidly hilarious, maybe it's gallows humor cartoon online today. It's the Pearly Gates, and the Pearly Gates, I didn't know that this is how it worked up there, but apparently there are different cues for the different way people died. So there are cues for Ebola and malaria and AIDS and wars and famines and heart attacks and cancer. And then there's a special cue for VIP coronavirus deaths. And the cancer queue is chock-a-block. There's no social distancing at the Pearly Gates for the cancer queue, nor for heart attacks, for famines, wars, or AIDS. And the VIP coronavirus queue has got three people in it. And it's just a wonderful way of illustrating that our very worst fears of the death rates so far in the coronavirus pandemic have been mercifully low worldwide in real terms, and compared to the outbreaks, of course, of the Spanish flu in 1919. Sure, we understand epidemiology better now than we did then. We understand virology. We understand the lessons of social distancing. And it doesn't mean that we don't get second and third waves of this vicious little virus. But it does show us that, I mean, you know, we mustn't forget that the world is still a vastly dangerous and deadly place, regardless of whether there's coronavirus around. And it's one of the reasons why people are saying, let's get the lockdown done, or at least the worst excesses of the lockdown done.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going during this crisis. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show. Good news for Comair that it may very well survive the fact that it is currently under business rescue. And we've not seen too many companies in South Africa's fairly tenuous and tender history in terms of business rescue come out of that process. It's a tough process, and far too often companies leave it far too long to go and look for help. And so as a result of that, so many companies do fail, and there are not that many business rescue practitioners around anymore either. And that's a concern also for the industry. But yeah, good news at Comair. We could very well survive business rescue, but it's going to be a while before you get back up in the skies. On your next Money Show, I'm featuring Vutlahari Valoy, Chief Executive and co-founder of the grocery delivery app Zulcy. This upstart has just secured big funding. It's done a massive deal that'll be featured this week as our shapeshifter. Cliff DeWitt from Dexterity Digital in our Business Unusual hot seat, and of course, consumer ninja Wendy Nola tackling all your big consumer issues. That's all coming up next time on The Money Show.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Well, the view from Franklin Templeton Emerging Markets today is that Africa cannot afford an extended hard lockdown in the COVID-19 crisis. The question is, can it afford to lift the lockdowns either? In many parts of the world, we're seeing infection rates decline. Not so across Africa, and certainly not in South Africa, where we're still seeing a growing trend. We're not expected, certainly in this country, to see a decline much before August, September. And that's possibly optimistic. Dinesh Ranchot is the Vice President and Executive Director of Franklin Templeton Emerging Markets Equity. What is the risk of cutting restrictions in a rising case environment, Dinesh, from an investor's perspective?
Hi, good evening, Bruce, and to your listeners. Yes. So, I mean, you know, naturally, I guess the risk would be that, you know, cases rise quite quickly. But, you know, if we take a step back and think about the lockdown, and, you know, lockdown, I think, had all intents, very good intentions. But I think we missed a few tricks. And three of them, I think, if I have to list them, one was that, you know, we didn't do the mass testing during the lockdown. We kind of only ramped it up towards the end of it. So the idea of limiting community transmission, which is what the lockdown was meant to do, didn't quite happen if we think about the number of cases that have arisen over the last six, seven weeks. The other thing we missed, I think, was, you know, the sort of tracking and tracing wasn't happening at the level that we should have. And I think the big reason for that is, essentially, you know, the test results were coming back between a period of 5 to 14 days. And in that period of time, 5 to 14 days, it's enough time for people to go around, mingle about, and as their viral load increases, they just become a lot more contagious. So it feels like we actually didn't do what we wanted to do, which is limit community transmission, and that's still ongoing. So if we do lift the restrictions in a meaningful way going forward, I don't think it will make much of a difference, even if we kept lockdown going. It looks like community transmission is here, and it's happening in a big way, irrespective of the lockdown. And in many ways, I think we sort of just really limiting and hurting economically many people in the country. And the risk is that, the longer we stay in lockdown, we see output on a permanent basis never coming back, jobs never coming back on a permanent basis.
Yeah, and that's the economic consequences, and the failure to quickly get off the ground and test and to nip this thing in the bud. I think that's been the great wasted opportunity that the lockdowns provided, where we've seen far more aggressive rollouts of testing in countries where other lockdowns have been. We're seeing declining numbers. Unfortunately for us, we did the lockdowns and then allowed these various hotbeds to fester. And spread, and that's unfortunately, part of the role of urbanization, really poor healthcare sector that's inadequately prepared for this. And yeah, it's playing catch up and doing some pretty impressive stuff right now, but there's been that 5-6 week postponement of real hard action.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, 100% Bruce. So, it's hard to compare South Africa or parts of Africa to what we've seen elsewhere, because even post the lockdown and post restrictions being removed, many of these countries are still implementing very strict hygiene controls, temperature checking, still ongoing testing, managing social distancing in a much better way. And they do use the tracking and tracing and the technology with smartphones, which we don't seem to have any sort of implementation or execution on. So I think that's the risk. We're caught in this a rock in a hard place, where we keep the lockdowns on the one side, it's sort of harmful to the economy, and as I mentioned earlier, we left the lockdowns, cases continue to spread, but we still haven't figured out how to sort of manage coming out of the lockdown. So those are the big points that I want to bring across.
Are you worried that we're going into, there's a huge amount of popular and populist pressure on government to ease the lockdown? So we've seen considerable easing of level 4. We headed towards level 3, I think, like it or not. We've got premiers talking about it, ANC premiers talking about it, as if it's a foregone conclusion. Angie Motshekga, the education minister, confirming tonight that grades 7 and 12 will go back to school from the 1st of June, and then it'll be phased after that. It's an acceptance that we can't keep people locked down in perpetuity. However, the consequences of raising lockdowns too soon and being forced to retrace and take a step back brings a whole new level of complexity. Is that not a concern for you, Dinesh?
It is, Bruce, but as I said, we've missed the window, and community transmission is increasing at a rapid rate. So even if we continue to stay in a level 3 for another month or two longer than we should, it doesn't look like we make a difference, So it feels like what we should do is kind of adopt what is happening in many other countries, that have come out of restrictions, is really focus on, doing the tracking and tracing properly, getting the apps. And if we want to do, this idea of targeted lockdowns or, regional or area lockdowns, that is something that's possible, but maybe you need to limit it to a suburb as opposed to a whole city or a whole province. So I think it is a concern, but I think there are ways of managing it, and we've seen that happen in many places in Asia, which seems to be a model. Fair enough that they obviously do have a better infrastructure for managing this, but that's not to say that South Africa can't do a lot. Things like tracking and tracing apps, they don't cost a lot of money. We already have almost 30,000 community healthcare workers out there, so they can actually be productive and actually help with the tracking and tracing. We can force businesses to adopt social distancing. So I think there's a lot that we can do if we do come out of a lockdown sooner. The overriding thing is that it is in the communities and the transmissions are taking place. So we kind of missed that inflection point. You know, I think we passed that. And now it's all about managing with what we have.
Dinesh Ranchat, thank you. Wise words indeed. Vice President and Executive Director at Franklin Templeton Emerging Markets Equity.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Some Money Show bedtime stories for you from some of the best writing around the world. This is a fabulous piece out of the New York Times for you to chew on this evening. The other night, I ate in a steakhouse. I have never been so happy to see a wedge salad in my life. I hadn't been to a restaurant since the 15th of March, a few days before Atlanta's mayor ordered all dining rooms to close. On the 27th of April, Georgia became the second state after Alaska to allow restaurants to reopen since the pandemic hit. Chops, a 31-year-old temple of expense account dining in the city's Buckhead neighborhood, was one of the first to jump back into business. My waiter, Roberto Velasco, seemed as happy to be back at work as I was to be sitting in a restaurant. At least he seemed happy. It was hard to tell behind his mask. For many people, the notion of eating in a restaurant still seems terrifying. It did to me. I sat at a table in the back and wondered if the coronavirus was floating down through the cool, conditioned air, or if one of the diners ordering Cabernet at a table 9 feet away from me was a carrier. Are you kidding me with a valet service? But Mr. Velasco's mask, along with the constant trips to the visible bottle of hand sanitizer, eased my anxiety. By the time a medium rare ribeye and a dish of asparagus arrived, I felt as dreamy as Dorothy in a field of poppies. In fits and starts around the country, restaurants are beginning to reopen, guided by a hodgepodge of federal, state and local laws and recommendations that seems to shift daily. Restaurant owners are left to devise their own practices, puzzling out how to minimize the health risk and reassure some customers without alienating others. It's a fabulous piece in the New York Times and well worth going to find and read in full. It's a lovely long feature piece about going back to restaurants. And the reason I mention this is because we are going to start going back into coffee shops and restaurants ourselves at some point. And we're going to be quite taken aback, I think, by the lackadaisical tone of some and the over-eagerness of others to impress. And the only point here is I think the world is experimenting to what you and I are going to find acceptable and whether or not we will want to put ourselves in a public space to be served by others and how we're going to expect that service to transpire. From the Atlantic, there's another lovely piece for you this evening, just a taste. In a normal year, lots of Americans, myself included, would be getting ready to attend summer weddings right now. Sea mining, new suits and sundresses, ordering gifts for the happy couples, writing toasts, rehearsing dance steps, securing vacation days to travel out of town. But as we all know by now, 2020 is no normal year. The global pandemic and social distancing policies that have put in place to curb the spread of COVID-19 have effectively ruled out large gatherings and made many people, in particular the elderly, much more hesitant to go far from home. En masse, weddings have been dramatically downsized, postponed or cancelled. The gauzy, fluttery dress I bought in February to wear to a friend's now postponed May wedding hangs solemnly in my closet, a delicate question mark suspended in thin air. A virtually non-existent wedding season of 2020 promises to be strange. A May to October stretch with an anomalous number of free weekends, and there's a strong possibility that this weirdness will last, that weddings as we know them, grand, festive events with extended family and friends in attendance, won't be the norm again for an awfully long time. Social distancing measures are likely to make big wedding celebrations essentially impossible for the rest of this year. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention still recommends that Americans cancel gatherings of more than 10 people for organizations that serve higher risk populations. And many states have imposed limits on the number of people who can gather for any sort of party or event. Again, disruption of the norm. I've got a young cousin whose wedding had to be postponed, and goodness knows when she's going to be able to make it all happen again. Lots of people were invited, and it was all set, and it was all going to be fabulous. And then a couple of weeks before, the cancellation WhatsApp came. Sorry, we're not doing this. Well, not yet. Anyway, it's changing lives, fundamentally.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, proudly brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, the bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going in this COVID-19 crisis. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show on this Tuesday evening. Andy Rice is standing by, sharpening his claws for heroes and zeros from the world of advertising. We've also got Neville Mandimika standing by. He is with RMB, bringing us the Africa Business Report. And then Prof. Nick Benedell talking to us about the research in environment, how to navigate the world of research studies and information in a COVID-19 crisis. There's so many university studies going on and so many millions of dollars being thrown at this issue of COVID-19 at universities around the world, and I'm sure they're all making marvelous progress, and that's really good. But how do we know what is real and what is hocus pocus, and where people are just wasting their time completely and money and resources in an effort to just get grant funding in order to do some research and to get famous? So we'll talk about that this evening here on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield.
Email him on bruce.w@702.co.za.
Andy Rice, our branding and advertising expert on The Money Show this evening. Your hero, please, Mr. Rice.
Hello, Bruce. How the devil are you?
I'm delightful, thank you, as you're asking about the devil. Yes, we're well, thank you. How is Andy in lockdown?
I'm bored, broke, and booze-free. Otherwise, I'm absolutely fine.
You poor thing. Sorry, I think you're reflecting the issues the nation faces, Andy. Bored, broken, booze-free, the three dreaded B's of the apocalypse.
Right, well, let's get on to the hero. I had to hope that over the course of the last few and the next few weeks, I would find a lot of things other than coronavirus-related pieces of advertising or communication, but I'm afraid that for the time being, I'm going to have to keep falling back on it. Happily, this time, it's a hero from that category. And obviously, we've spoken a lot in the past about social distancing. And I've tried to make the point that what we need is not to tell people what to do, but to give them engaging and enjoyable reasons to believe the message and then get on with it. And if you take the principal thing about social distancing, everybody has stressed, it's keep 2 meters distant. And no matter where you go, I'm not just talking about South Africa, although it's very common here, but everywhere you go, they link the 2 meters with the social distancing. And I suspect that after a while, that starts to wash over people. I think that there's nothing particularly interesting. You're being told to be 2 meters apart, fine. And whether you do or you don't, is more about how you're feeling about things at the time. And this may have been the thinking behind some campaigns that I've seen, which have been going viral on Twitter. And it's examples from other countries on how to get the message keep 2 meters apart to be noticed and perhaps acted upon. And so what they've done in a number of places is they've taken the 2 meter distance and said, well, let's translate that into other units of measure, if you like. So the first one I saw was from Toronto, the city, presumably, of Toronto in Canada. And they say, do your part, stay apart, which is fair enough. But then the illustration that supports this on signage around the city is to have two silhouettes of people, one hopes, 2 meters apart. But it says the correct distance is 3 geese apart, and there's certain little silhouettes of 3 geese between the couple in the photograph. And there are others like that from Australia. Keep one adult kangaroo distant. From I think it's New Jersey, 1 dolphin apart, 1 llama apart from somewhere in South America. For me, that gets people to think about the distance, and as they're walking outside, perhaps it just makes them think, well, like, 3 geese apart is a nicer piece of thing, a nicer piece of communication to obey than 2 meters apart. So 4 marks for me for all of those different ways of demonstrating. And there is one other that's not about a piece of advertising, but it is equally entertaining, I think, memorable. And that is that there's a German cafe that has reopened post the lockdown there in Germany. And in order to dine at the cafe, you have to take a hat that's given to you on arrival, and the hat has pool noodles attached, like propeller blades on your head. And the two noodles represent a distance of 2 meters. And if you get your pool noodle entangled with a fellow diner's or another diner alongside, then you're in big trouble because you're closer than 2 meters. I think that kind of thing is memorable, creative, and more likely to work than simple authoritarian schoolmasterly, like, keep 2 meters apart.
I wonder what would work in South Africa. I mean, in suburbia, two Labradors and a Jack Russell. Yuck.
Exactly.
A kudu apart, a nyala apart, or something along those lines. But not everybody knows a kudu size or a nyala size. It'd be quite an interesting exercise, actually, to see just how far apart we in South Africa should stay. If anybody's got any ideas, 31702, 31567. There was a wonderful woman who worked at Sun International many years ago. She perhaps still does. Her name is Sue Clerk, and Sue was in marketing at Sun International, and in involved lots of social activity. And what Sue hated was people coming in to give her a kiss on the cheek. And so what she used to do is to wear these broad-brimmed, quite floppy hats so that nobody could actually navigate the brim of this droopy hat. And invariably, it would be fringed with something like ostrich feather or something. So it was a wonderful social distancing tool. And I'm thinking everybody should wear a broad-brimmed... I mean, you've got to wear... What are the Mexican hats called? A big, massive sombrero.
Sombrero, yes.
And if everybody wore a sombrero, we would go some way to creating that sort of 2 meters apart. But yes, it is this lovely idea of speaking consumer language, isn't it? Because if you can get people to relate to your message in a human way, then we start visualizing what you're proposing rather than trying to, you know, wash your hands for 20 seconds, the same length as two happy birthdays. I'm so sick of that damn happy birthday song now, I can't tell you. So we need happy signals. So 31702, 31567, if you can come up with a South African equivalent of three geese or an adult kangaroo or a dolphin, something better than two Alsatians and half a Jack Russell or something along those lines. But talking about...
I can't think why six cases of wine have sprung into my head. I can't imagine why, but anyway...
It's so troubling if you put six cases of wine down between two people, they'd all disappear really quickly. They'd just get stolen. So, Andy Rice, I talk about humanizing advertising and making adverts sound as if they are designed to be consumed and enjoyed by human beings. I would like you, please, to have a listen to this one and give your prognosis on it, please, Dr. Rice.
The Eisenhower Matrix correctly states that which is urgent is not necessarily important. All too often, certain types of philosophies, mindsets, and persuasions can and do have an effect on what is considered urgent, even where such may be unimportant. Cut through the maze and bias. Maximize your performance with scientific research data. Plus 94 Research. Dynamic, intellectual, authentic.
That's very important sounding, Andy Rice. Why don't you like it? Why is that your zero?
Well, I think that in all advertising, but especially radio perhaps, there are a number of variables that you have to address, and you need to get more or less all of them right for the advertising to work. So you've got the idea itself, you've got the copywriting skills, the wordsmithing, you've got the voice that you choose to deliver it, and you've got the tone in which that voice would deliver, and so on. And if you get all of these variables right, you're quite likely to have an advertisement that's a long way down the road to effectiveness. But if you allow one of them to, or more than one of them, to dominate and go in the opposite direction, you're in trouble. And I think my opinion, of course, is, as opposed to having any research to back it up, appropriately enough, but my opinion is that this particular campaign gets things wrong in that regard. I think it's quite stuffy. It's almost pompous. I think the delivery is stilted. And I think some of the language talking about cutting through the maze and bias, I'm not sure that the South African business community is necessarily looking for a research company that is dynamic, intellectual, and authentic. I find that a very insincere, however wrong that might be, but seems like a very insincere promise to me of being intellectual. Yeah, sure, maybe they are, but is that what the market wants? I just find the whole advertising for 30 seconds kind of puts me off, and that's why it's a zero.
Thank you, Andy Rice. Can I give you a couple of South African solutions to to social distancing? Two vuvuzelas apart. I mean, that's something we can relate to. Add an extra one in just in case somebody needs to blow it. A minibus taxi width apart is kind of a harder sell, but it's about the right distance. And we all know the width of a minibus taxi. We know that a 2 meter wide minibus taxi can fit through a 1.5 meter gap. four Hardy Dars apart. That's lovely. I like that.
I like that one. Yeah.
And then my favorite, and it's one that we can all relate to, and France, thank you for this one, because this is a great South African, well, an African symbol of wealth, and we all relate to cows. A cow apart. So a cow's length apart, not a cow's width apart. The length of a cow is 3 geese, an adult kangaroo, a dolphin, 2 Alsatians and a Jack Russell. France, I think you've nailed it. A cow apart, would be the way we might do it in South Africa. Andy Rice, thank you. Branding and advertising expert Andy Rice this evening on The Money Show.
The Africa Business Report.
Andre Pretoria suggests we go 2 Braaigrids apart. The problem with that, Andre, is the Braaigrid traditionally brings us together. And so I think that would be a terrible failure. Neville Mandimika is an Africa strategist at Rand Merchant Bank on the line to us from Johannesburg this evening. We need to talk about Ghana's Monetary Policy Committee decision. But before we do that, Neville, just sketch for me, please, the structure and the state of the Ghanaian economy as things stand.
Yeah, so the Ghanaian economy is one of those economies that personally I do like. I think we've seen some proper reforms over the last couple of years, underscored by an IMF program that they successfully exited, and that gave them the momentum as they went into this crisis in terms of fiscal credibility and policy making. I mean, the guys really talk a very good and slick game, and it's been shown up in the numbers. And I think their response to this particular crisis has been quite impressive, if I may say so myself.
Oh, okay, so give me a sense then of how they have responded.
So it was one of the first countries to actually enact a lockdown that lasted for 3 weeks, relatively short period of time compared to what we're going through here. But what they resolved is that they had tested a significant size or at least chunk of their portion to be in a position where they can or at least feel confident that they are managing new cases within Ghana. I think they've got a little over 1,000 cases there and a relatively small portion of that in debt. So that lockdown lasted for about 3 weeks, and then they've gradually reopened the economy to try and resuscitate some economic activity. Unfortunately for them, by our own estimates, it's one of those countries in Africa where they might register some growth in 2020, although it might be a little bit small. We're looking at about 2% growth this year. They went into this crisis with an estimate of about 6% growth. So it's taken a knock, but it's growth nonetheless.
No, exactly. I mean, that is a remarkable achievement, considering how few economies in the world are going to register growth. Most economies in the world, certainly significant economies, are going to contract, including our own. So Ghana's in fairly decent shape, in other words, relative to the rest of the world. What are the monetary policy authorities doing in Ghana then to help this process?
So the less interesting bit in terms of the announcement that we saw on Friday was that they kept rates on hold at 14.5%. But the two interesting announcements was the first one, they managed to secure a $1 billion repurchase facility with the Federal Reserve Bank out in the U.S., whereby they place treasuries as collateral in exchange for $1 billion. What that does is it significantly improves the FX liquidity. As you can imagine, a relatively small economy like Ghana compared to South Africa, they've got quite a fair bit of sensitivities in terms of FX liquidity. So securing collateral of $1 billion in size, I think that goes a very, very long way, not only improving FX liquidity, but also reassuring investors that, the economy is in good footing. And then secondly, we saw the announcement of a bond buying program. So in keeping in line with the emerging market countries ranging from Chile to Poland, I mean, they began their own version of QE. But unlike a lot of the emerging market economies, they were very explicit in terms of the maximum amount that the central bank is going to be buying in terms of government treasuries. And that number sits at 10 billion cedis. So that was quite constructive in terms of... Sorry, go on, Bruce.
No, no, you carry on, Neville. You're the one with the interesting stuff to say, not me. You carry on.
So that was quite interesting in the sense that these were two landmark announcements that are obviously very appropriate given the times that we're in at this stage in terms of reassuring investors and corporates alike that have got exposure to Ghana to say, look, they're on top of this particular crisis and they're trying to solve some economic growth. So the implication on that, I think, is it's twofold. Firstly, we're likely going to be seeing some currency stability in terms of the Ghanaian cedi. So for context, the cedi relative to the U.S. dollar has lost only about 2.5% on a year-to-date basis compared to about 14% weakness in most emerging market currencies. So they've done relatively well in terms of trying to keep the cedi very stable. So that should play out very well when it comes to inflation and obviously mitigating against an all-out balance of payments crisis. So we're quite excited in terms of how the policymakers in Ghana are doing in terms of ensuring that the economy stays on track.
I mean, is Ghana the best positioned economy in Africa right now?
Not quite. I mean, I could answer that from several perspectives, but I think purely from a growth perspective, I think the likes of Senegal, Cote d'Ivoire, Egypt may very well register some growth. And I think these are the countries that went into this crisis on a relatively decent footing. And I think it underscores the importance of how you actually get into a crisis as it determines how you actually exit it. So here, obviously, in South Africa, we were teetering on the brink of recession. Then obviously we're getting hit by the issues of COVID-19 now. And some of these economies are growing at, comfortably over 5%. So how you get into the crisis, I think, really determines your options and your policy responses.
And then when you look at South Africa and its responses, I mean, massive criticism, of course, of the South African government for the extent of the lockdown. There are very aggressive attempts to lighten the load of the lockdown and the impact. We're seeing the education minister this evening talking about opening up schools and doing that gradually and responsibly. Our economy is contracting and probably at least three times worse contraction than in 2008-2009. For South Africa and its Monetary Policy Committee meeting, which is happening today, tomorrow, and again on Thursday, and the decision on Thursday, are you expecting another big rate cut in an environment where inflation is virtually non-existent, other than in the healthcare sector perhaps right now? What sort of policy options are really open to South Africa in this context?
Look, I think it would be remiss of us to criticize how the authorities have dealt with this crisis. We're obviously facing a very real humanitarian crisis, and I think the lockdown was obviously very necessary in terms of ensuring that the pandemic is kept under control. As for the fiscal responses, I mean, some of my colleagues who look at the SA economy are fairly comfortable that the fiscal packages that have been announced will go some way in terms of cushioning the economy. So for context, if for example we hadn't seen the fiscal announcement that we had, and we're looking at a plus 6% contraction, you can imagine how worse it would be if we had, or at least if the authorities had adopted the sort of laissez-faire approach. And again, the monetary policy side of things, and we're really seeing a coordination between fiscal and monetary policy, not only South Africa, but I think across the continent as well, which is needed at this stage. I think the worst case scenario that any country can find itself in is if it doesn't have fiscal options and it has to rely on one leg, which is monetary policy. And I think not only South Africa, but across the continent, we're seeing a fairly balanced, obviously varying degrees, but a fairly balanced approach to fiscal and monetary responses to this crisis.
Neville Mandimika, he is an RMB economist. He's the RMB Sub-Saharan Africa economist. Neville Mandimika this evening on the line to us from Johannesburg.
Bruce Whitfield on 702. Call Bruce on 011-883-0702.
Welcome to The Money Show, our How It Works feature this evening, featuring Professor Nick Benedell, professor at the Gordon Institute of Business Science. And what we asked Nick Benedell to look at this evening was how you navigate the world of research, of studies, of information when you've got the COVID-19 crisis, because there must be 1,000 institutions, of education institutions around the world, all scurrying around for fame and fortune, looking to have breakthroughs when it comes to research and how to deal with COVID-19. Nick Benedell has been in academia for much of his career. and joins us on the line from Joburg this evening. Nick Benedel, how is things in the world of charity on the one hand, because I know you've been very busy with feeding schemes and lockdown academia?
Hello, Bruce. Yep, those are the contradictions we're all living under in this new COVIDian world, where on the one hand, it's good to be active and do something that helps others. On the other hand, some time to step back and think about how we can assist people moving forward, organizations and individuals.
Because this is, I mean, you know, before we get into the research and everything else, but this is a very significant global dislocation, whether it comes as a short, sharp shock that we get over quite quickly, or whether it's protracted and prolonged and fundamentally changes the structure of how we live, work, and play, is yet to be seen.
Yes, I mean, it's affected almost every aspect of our lives. I was thinking about kaleidoscopes I had when I was a kid, I don't know if you ever had one, but you'd look down a tube and you'd see a beautiful pattern, you give it one twist and everything changed. And that was a short, sharp shock. Alvin Toffler warned us about a thing called future shock. He said the rate of change would happen so exponentially that people would struggle with it. Well, none of us predicted we'd have such a holistic, invisible shock to every aspect of human life in the speed with which this has happened.
I mean, do you see it as all bad? I mean, to take the health aspects and park that for a second. Is this disruption necessarily all bad?
No, it's definitely not all bad, because there are upsides to this. It will produce a lot of innovation. Economic, technological, scientific innovation will come out of this challenge. And so it's not all bad. But of course, there are things that won't be the same again. And many subsystems will simply dry up and not come back. So if you think about the nature of the way we work, for sure, we'll work more digitally, and that'll have impact on how buildings are used, you know, the value of land and property, et cetera, et cetera. So not all of it's good, that's for sure, because so much damage is being done to the economy, to society. There's a lot of concern all over the world about livelihoods versus lives, as we've debated.
Tell me then about the opportunity here for academia to not only learn from what is happening, but also to lead in a time of crisis when it comes to helping make sense of it all.
Well, I mean, that's ultimately, you know, universities have two roles. The one is to teach and prepare a next generation, but the primary role of universities is to conduct research. And that's the tradition of universities, why all of us who end up as scholars do a PhD, is to do original research in some or other field. And of course, this the huge nature, the holistic nature of this generates research in every aspect of a university's life, from the medical to the scientific, to the social, to the economic. Everyone's now asking different sets of questions. And the job of a university is to serve society, to serve the world, to serve humanity by trying to come up and ponder about defining what the questions are we're trying to answer, and then either conducting experiments if you're in the hard sciences, or probing theories and developing theories in the social sciences as to what the answers are to these questions. And that's the role of research. It's to develop ideas and test them rigorously as possible in a field. There was a huge breakthrough in the 1960s by a man called Thomas Kuhn, who investigated how science develops. And there are two ways it develops. One is incrementally and slowly, the search for answers to a particular disease or a particular engineering problem that happens incrementally in small bits as academics and others chip away at it. And then there are the big bang scientific revolutions that come along. And at the moment, I'm not sure what COVID is, because it's a virus. We know a lot about virology. But it's got a new shape and impact that makes it quite original. So it'll be interesting to see all the Nobel Prize potential winners out there, as you say, in their thousands of labs, trying to develop an answer to this particular medical pandemic. And then all the scholars applying their minds, because it's shaken all our lives up as to what the social and economic and even political implications are.
How then, I mean, when we look at, let's just look at the scientific for a moment, and then we'll focus on the social and economic later, because that's really interesting stuff, because it changes society and it changes the way we live and work and play. But if we look at the science of this thing and the race for a cure, this is, you know, this is the Cold War nuclear arms race all over again, but this time possibly for the good of humankind.
Yes, it's like the search for Ebola, around Ebola and HIV/AIDS, where companies and societies, governments funded research to try and find the best kind of solution that could be found over time. And eventually this was found for HIV/AIDS. We managed to not avoid the disease, but we managed to control its effects. And so that's what a vaccine does. A vaccine is an antibody that helps the immune system fight off a bacteria. That one of the first was smallpox in 1796. Measles in 1796. Smallpox in 1928. I was doing some research about it. 18% of soldiers died from bacterial infection in the First World War. In the Second World War, less than 1%, because antibiotics had been developed by Alexander Fleming and others. And so there was a solution to a defined problem. And that's, of course, what we're all hoping for.
But the time it takes to deliver the solutions, the scientific solutions, has always been protracted, because there's a huge amount of risk associated with doing medical tests and testing on human beings, for example. In times of crisis like this, is there a risk that we mess it up?
Yes, there is, I suppose. You know, if you look at the US and how they're trying to short circuit the approval process, there is a risk. And then you've got to weigh up, as a policy, it's a political decision, to weigh up the amount of risk you take with using a particular solution that has not been fully tested, as it would be in normal science. In normal science, we would take a few years to develop, in this particular case, a vaccine. But because of the scale of the problem, if it keeps growing in certain societies the way it has, people will take a risk to try and find a cure. And of course, in science, you go through, these days, the pharmacology or the bioscience is often computer generated, of trying different mixes of formulations, etc., in the pharmaceutical industry, and trying to come up with a solution, and then to develop the solution itself and test it, normally on some innocent mice, and from there, hopefully, that one can transpose that into human tests. And scientific research always works the same way. You give two equal groups different treatments. The one treatment, you try the experimental intervention, and then you measure the outcome of both groups. The one did not have an intervention, and the other one did. And that's how science basically works.
And we're seeing this happening at scale in universities across the globe right now. Do you see, and this is an impossible question to answer, but I'm interested in your view on it, from what you understand of the world, from what you understand of geopolitics, from what you understand of this rising surge of nationalism, put America first, China first, Japan first, whatever it might be. Do you see hoarding of potential solutions? Do you see the open sourcing, perhaps, for the first time, once we start finding radical interventions to treating COVID-19, so that an Aspen PharmaCare is as capable as a GlaxoSmithKline of producing in-country a solution to the pandemic?
It's a very interesting question. And I suppose we're talking about two things. One is the research and development, and then the other is the production. I was privileged to work with General Electric in the Middle East, where we called Africa and Middle Eastern ministers of health and hospital systems together. And one of the things we talked about, this was about 7-8 years ago, was vaccines and how quickly a vaccine can be produced and then shared. And there are systems for doing this. So my hope would be, in a global pandemic, that we don't get into a geopolitical contestation, although we're seeing some of that, as you rightly said, but we take a humanitarian point of view and make whatever comes out as widely available as quickly as possible. And from what when I poked my nose into that field, I was very impressed by the systems that are available, that the CDC and other similar centers would do everything they could to disperse the medicine and not for it to be used as a power play between bigger economies or bigger powers and smaller powers.
Because when it comes to economics, I mean, this is the single biggest universal economic threat that humanity has faced in our lifetimes. And it's a common threat and it's a common enemy. And surely it therefore would make sense. And again, these things make sense theoretically anyway, that everybody gets to fight it equally at the same time to eradicate a pandemic, because it's no good to anybody if the pandemic sits festering in one territory but is under control in another, when you're trying to return to normalize global trade and trying to get the world moving again.
Exactly. So you have to make an assumption about the nature of leaders and ask whether a particular leader is a statesman or more of a patriot and a nationalist, more inward-looking than outward-looking. And of course, the real calculation is this is a huge, it's like the environmental issues that we've been failing to face. These are global issues, the decline of the health of the environment. Here we have a particular medical problem. So it pays humanity much better off to ignore national boundaries or ideologies, because it pays everyone off to fix the system and allow us to get back to a kind of new normal where we have a productive life. So I think it's a failure of imagination and leadership to be petty and small-minded about it. And in that sense, it would be silly not to comment on the US. The US is such a young country. I always say it's often like a teenager. It's big muscles and a small memory. And it doesn't really take on the global view very often because it's a young, in some way, immature society. And I've lived there for many years and I adore the US. But it does have the character of being petulant. And I think Trump's leadership falls a long mile short of the kind of statesmanship that one would expect from a hegemon, from a superpower. On the other hand, China has a lot of work to do to recover its reputation. So hopefully they don't miscalculate the odds of these major superpowers and realize it's in everyone's interest to share. And if we share, we'll all do better and the whole system will come back to life far faster and in a far more humane and generous way.
Because we've seen the election in recent years, the last 5 years, particularly of more nationalistic sort of leaders, whether it be Boris Johnson's of the United Kingdom, the Erdogan's of Turkey, the Bolsonaro's of Brazil, a vast array of far more put our own country first leaders looking to try and solve economic problems. But this is a fundamentally different threat and a fundamentally different challenge. Professor Nick Benedell, who's a professor at the Gordon Institute of Business Science, fascinating chewing the fat with him about the role of universities and academia in trying to deliver not only medical solutions, but also then trying to understand the social consequences of what is happening in this massive dislocation that's happening in the world at the moment, and also the economic consequences. We'll pick up on those points in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going during this crisis. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
So much about this crisis is understanding the virology. It's about understanding the epidemiology. It's about understanding how to control the medical aspects of a crisis. And that's one very important part of it. But the rest of it is also incredibly important. It's the social fabric of society is under huge stress at the moment. And then economies around the world, and most particularly here in South Africa, are under an enormous amount of pressure as a result of the very necessary steps to lock down the economy for a period of time. And we're looking toward a day when this economy is going to open up somewhat. So let's talk to Professor Nick Benedell this evening about the role of universities and understanding social dynamics in a time of disruption. How do they go about beginning to figure this out, Nick?
Well, Bruce, because this is such a new phenomenon, a lot of what we need to explore, we're not even sure what the questions are yet, let alone the answers. So a lot of this will be exploratory, whether it's in psychology or sociology or in economics, trying to understand what's at work. What's very striking to me is that every country has a different set of features that determine how either the policy gets made or executed or not, how people formulate the problem, how they speculate about possible solutions. There's a lovely term in biology called, I'm going to share it with you, it's allopatric speciation. And what that means is when a species gets separated for some reason, it starts to develop different features. If you look at South Africa's economic structure, our social structure, our identity, our geographic differences within the country, we each have our own response. So our medical and healthcare system has a particular set of resources, structures, and skills that have to come together to deal with us. The same is true of the economy, and the same is true of our politics. So these are emerging phenomena as to how different subsystems of the country then start defining the problem and start exploring how to work together or start exploring how to solve the problem. Let's take the grant system where we've adjusted the grants, still very, very small, but we made a slight adjustment within our very limited means. So every country has a set of features that are structural or are systems that determine their response. One of the key features is the quality of leadership and how leaders define the problem to be solved. And I think that's been very interesting in this country because we followed an aggressive lockdown policy and it's quite controversial and that still has to be tested.
And, I mean, times like this really test the tolerance of voters for their politicians. And there's a very real risk here that any governing party in a time of a crisis like this is damned if it doesn't, damned if it doesn't in terms of the way that it deals with this. It's going to have to make trade-offs. It's going to have to make big decisions. And depending on how it plays it, it either stays in power the next time voters line up to choose their leaders, or they get a big blood nose. And, for example, the ANC with a 55% majority at the moment is, you know, on edge, really, relative to where it was. It had enough problems going into this crisis. This either makes or breaks it, surely.
I'm not sure. If I remember back to the 80s when the National Party ruled the roost, it had big debates and arguments, but the voters still supported it, even though the world rejected its policies. So there's a certain momentum in our cultural, political life where that's a big assumption that you're making that people might change their electoral preferences, even if it's rational to do so. Sometimes it doesn't lead to that change in behavior. So yes, the stakes are very, very high, which is why I believe the government has declared it kind of emergency it has and put the troops on the streets and passed the act that it did to give it control. And we'll see how that plays out politically. I do think South Africans are fairly conservative and loyal in their political choices. And so the judgment of ordinary voters is yet to be seen, even though they've taken a tremendous hit. You know, in the informal settlements I've been in, the impact of this has been catastrophic. But who they will attribute the blame for, I think we're more sophisticated than that. I'm not sure it'll just be a gut reaction.
Because so much of this then depends on economic outcomes, and that's why there is so much pressure on government to begin to relieve the economic constraints that we're operating under right now.
Yes, of course, and that's where business is engaging with the government wherever possible about the process of risk-adjusted opening. And hopefully, we're all hoping that in the next week or so, we'll get an announcement about level three and understand what that means, because we all want to get back to work. We don't want a society as becoming even more unequal than it's been. And the impoverishment of up to 30 million people is a human catastrophe in South Africa. So we want to get back to work. We want the economy to open up, but we've got to balance off, as we're all saying, between life and livelihoods. And those are terrible dilemmas for leaders to face. And in an absence of information, where we don't have a sound theory of what COVID is and how to treat it, it makes it even more difficult.
So the pressure then on institutions such as yours and universities across the globe is to really tear this thing apart and truly interrogate every single aspect of COVID-19 and its implications for us all.
Yes. So, I mean, if you look at university life to start with, of course, we're not operating the way we did. So the first big shift was to go digital. And the second is to then ask yourself, what's the research agenda, as you just said, that institutions such as Gibbs, such as the University of Pretoria and all the other good universities need to start addressing? And what resources have you got to address them? And how do you, just by government, how do you shift the resources into studying the new phenomenon? And how do you learn from other countries and the research they're doing? Scholars tend to collaborate more easily than politicians, I think, across the world. So, you know, we learn from everybody and what they're doing. and I'm sure whether it's in the economy or social dynamics, sociology or the psychology of it, we'll be all collaborating on trying to understand what the effects of it are and how they differ from country to country. South Africa is a resilient country. We have resilient people, and that all of these things then come together for scholars to try and assist society by doing some groundbreaking research, starting by gathering data, by doing case studies, by getting information as the game moves on, and making sure that that information goes into the systems of governance, whether they're business, labor, or government itself, to inform the policymakers and help them grope their way into what is a very difficult environment to predict.
Nick Benedell, we must leave it there. Thank you so much for your time this evening. Nick Benedell.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Cheers, Nick.